You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website RickAckerman.com. Where are you speaking to us from today?
Well, I'd say sunny Florida, but it's not too sunny today, Jim. It's kind of cloudy and overcast, and the weather report says it's going to rain any minute now. So, and that's great with me because the 90 degree heat here just lasted forever. But I think we're finally in autumn.
Well, it's November in Vancouver, which means we're expecting 3 inches of rain today.
But also tomorrow as well, right?
Yep. Oh, yeah. Well, that's why we have 250-foot tall trees. They get lots of water. Rick, AI, is it, trillions of dollars have been put into it now. Is this a bad investment? Is this like the dot-com bubble back in 2000?
It is. There's no way... I try to ask questions that are obvious enough that I can make the point, but there was, I think, a Bloomberg headline, maybe it was Wall Street Journal, and it was talking about, you know, trillion-dollar bubble in AI, but that doesn't even begin to address the amount of money that's been going into AI in circular fashion. You know, when somebody gets financing, you got 100 smaller companies that are there, eating raw AI meat. It just pumps everything up, really. So it's not $1 trillion we're talking about. I think within you extrapolate out just even for the next 6 to 12 months, it's more like $10 trillion, and that's real money. That's not like I know you kind of you measure it against our assets, like pumped up home values and things like that, and it seems like it's not much, but of course those pumped up home values are going to evaporate the same as the stock market will when we're on a down slope, which I think we may be on.
Now, AI, how smart is it? We just saw a warning on our evening news saying that AI hallucinations, people shouldn't believe it because it makes up things like giving out the wrong phone numbers for the Burnaby RCMP.
Well, that's the least of our problems right now. I think the recent advancement adding Sora to ChatGPT gives it the capability of doing videos. You can just sort of say what you want to happen in a video, and it gives you a Hollywood quality video. All right, so I'm familiar with these short, punchy videos because I'm addicted to YouTube's version of them. You know, I'll get on YouTube, and they can keep me locked into it for 3 hours if they want, because they just know I love old clips with the Muhammad Ali fights, and I love to watch Javier do his moonwalk and shuffle dancing, and they know exactly what you want, all right? And what's happened very recently, and I mean within the last month, all the kids are playing with Sora, and they've literally swamped YouTube with these videos that are sort of a 14-year-old's idea of cool stuff, cool videos of what would happen if a bear came up on someone's back porch and was attacking the guy sitting there reading his newspaper, and his little kitty cat comes out and chases the bear away. So we've got a lot of conflict there between mongooses and cobras and some unlikely matchups like opossums versus lowland gorillas and things like that. And so what's happened is we've enabled the visual imagination of 14-year-olds to take over the videoscape. And I don't think this is lost on the jackasses in Hollywood, and I'm talking about Disney there, who produce films, because right now the capability to produce a Hollywood quality film is just about there for a 12-year-old. So the entertainment industry, at least any entertainment that's produced and sold to anybody, it could be background music in an elevator, it could be films for exhibit in theaters or whatever, they're all dead in the water. And we're going to get so flooded with images that the ability of an image to inspire something in you that can persuade you that it's real, it's nothing's real anymore. Because really, we've opened a Pandora's box here, and because video images are really what all our vendors, everybody from Big Pharma to Milky Way chocolate bars, they all use images to sell. And now images are going to be so corrupted that we're not going to be able to tell real from fake, and we'll have to assume that it's all fake. So that's a much, much bigger concern, I think, than this idea about whether some written piece gets its facts wrong, gets hallucinates or whatever. We're pretty familiar with that. But the whole visual landscape and the way our brains process visual images is about to be radically changed.
How long do you think the stock market can continue on its rise before things go bleak, bust, and turn just into a disaster?
I think it stopped on October 30th, the day before Halloween, with the top of the E-mini S&Ps. It didn't quite get to my target. I was looking for 7,057.50 in the December E-mini S&Ps, and we didn't quite get there. We got to about 6,900 and change, so we missed by 100 and some points. And yeah, I'm wary about saying that's it, the top is in, because I've wrongly predicted 100 tops over the years. But rather than say, well, we've topped in some definitive way, I'm saying we're in a topping process. And I think the backdrop for that is ideal, because we're in the best of worlds, of all worlds, where Trump is going to make America great again, and everything's right with the world, which we know is not true. We know everything's right from an investment standpoint for that wealthy 20% of Americans. But as my colleague Charles Hugh Smith points out, we've already crashed for the American middle class. They're in something like a deep recession, if not to say depression, and that's the way it is. So to talk about make America great with the entire American middle class being crushed by higher prices for everything, that's not a healthy economy.
Is there a cure for that?
Is there a what for?
A cure for the U.S. economy, the middle class economy.
Oh, absolutely. There always has been a cure, and that's a ruinous deflation, and that's what we're headed into. It seems somewhat paradoxical, because, of course, the big concern is inflation and its impact on the affordability of pretty much everything. But the cure is deflation, and deflation will cancel out all debts. And I know that a lot of people react to that in the stupid way of the person who thinks, well, you know, if I can't make payments on my house, I'll leave the keys in the mailbox and I'll walk away. And most people think that the debt has been canceled, but it hasn't. The bondholders are going to eat every penny of the loss. So that's what's happened. You know, in the end, as C.V. Myers wrote back in 1976 in a book called The Coming Deflation, every penny of every debt has to be paid, if not by the borrower, then by the lender. And it's happening in a very subtle and pernicious way right now, because we can see an absolute collapse in goods, and the quality of goods and the quality of services. And by services, I mean everything from telemedicine, where you don't get to visit your doctor in person. He just kind of watches you on a screen. And no one's really seems too upset that he doesn't really get to look in your ears and see, as my urgent care doctor did the other week. He said, look, I've been coughing for weeks, and he took a look in my ears, and he said, you know, the eardrum is supposed to be pink and lie flat, and yours is bulging a little bit, and it's kind of gray. And from that, he concluded that I had a bacterial buildup in my sinuses, so he gave me the right antibiotics and drugs for that, and lo and behold, the cough went away. You can't do that with telemedicine. You know, telemedicine is just inferior medicine, and it's one way, an other than direct dollars way, that we pay off all debt in the way that C.V. Myers said. And probably the biggest payment we've made against our debt, and a lot of it really goes to our standard of living, is that some time ago, after the bra burning outside Convention Hall in Atlantic City in the 60s, feminism reached a point where, it had to happen from economics necessity. You know, the working woman became an established fact after that, and I hope we've learned that it wasn't so much because women, by and large, wanted to work rather than be homemakers. They were forced into the marketplace, and we're still, the newspapers are still belaboring that illusion with all these stories about, hey, here's a story about a woman bull rider or a woman this or a woman that, but the whole, what's really impelled it is it's financial necessity. Everybody's got to work, and these days, even a professional couple, you know, he's a doctor, she's a lawyer, they're barely making ends meet. So we paid in that way because most families could not have afford to have a spouse stay home to watch the kids. That was a huge hit to the standard of living. It's I guess I won't call it an invisible way in which we pay off our debts, but it is certainly a way.
Do you think gold has peaked, or is it going to continue rising, perhaps hitting 10 grand?
I've gone back and forth on gold. You know, I never believed the Jim Sinclairs and those guys who were talking about $50,000 an ounce for a while. And I guess this is still valid. I thought that Trump's idea, not that anybody knows about it, to monetize gold was a net positive for gold, because the price of gold had to get up to around $5,000, supposedly, where that becomes an asset that Trump would hawk in behalf of all of us. And there was, you know, a similar plan to monetize the equity in our homes that I think we've talked about before. But I'm now thinking that gold is not going to ascend to some astronomical height. The highest logical and obvious target I can project with technical methods is just a little bit over $5,000 an ounce. And in trying to square that with fundamental logic, the only thing I could come up with is that gold at $5,000 could level off, remain stable, or only come down somewhat, but relative to all other classes of investable assets, that would be great. In other words, if you're holding gold in comparison with any other thing you can invest in, and I mean particularly Bitcoin, you're going to do just fine. That's always been my contention, that gold would be a good investment. And, you know, I've been a strong advocate of that in any conversation we've had over the last several years, but treasuries as well, more recently. So that's where I think you should be, treasuries and gold. But gold does not have to soar to some ridiculous level to do just fine as a store of value and as a an excellent investment.
We'll have more with Rick Ackerman right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Rick Ackerman. Rick, is Bitcoin overpriced?
Well, we've talked about that a lot, too, and I think Bitcoin was a great value. I think it had intrinsic value up to around somewhere between $2.50 and $4 per, but certainly not $126,000. And I keep pointing to the fact that there's really nothing there. There's nothing behind Bitcoin. And when all the hucksters out there promoting Bitcoin, like Saylor, when they bullet point all of the good things about Bitcoin, the bullet points are, well, Bitcoin, there's scarcity. That's the only thing they have to say about Bitcoin. It's a peculiarity that Bitcoin has become, it's gotten officially recognized. Trump was a natural to come in and say, hey, I love this Bitcoin. He took a dive in, and then, of course, he's become more than just a passive fan of Bitcoin. So, and I was talking with a friend of mine yesterday who's done really well. Started out as a clerk on a Pacific Stock Exchange, and he came to own office buildings and things like that. And he's always been very astute in his timing as far as getting out of selling his buildings, his real estate holdings. And he's also been buying 1,000-ounce ingots of silver since, well, going back forever. And he mentioned, he said, the Bitcoin, or at least the stable coin part of it, and of course the use of the word stable is on the part of Trump and his promoters, it's not ironic at all. It's just it's very seductive to think that the government is contemplating a plan that would allow some capital to flow into that reserve, into stablecoin. But I get a feeling, even with the government's endorsement, it's not going to be quite stable, or the mechanism that keeps it stable is going to be under a great deal of stress. But the fundamental idea that the government should be interested in stablecoin or a crypto medium as a place where they could offload stresses in the dollar market, they could make the world less dependent on dollars. To me, that's really scary, because it's one thing for Trump to think about trying to get us out of debt by, well, essentially borrowing on home equity and borrowing on whatever gold is there in Fort Knox, but it's a totally different thing to borrow against a valuation that has been assigned to a cryptocurrency. So that to me is really spooky, because any way you cut, slice, or dice it, although you can create, you know, houses are real and gold is real, but to essentially hypothecate something that's not real, like crypto, to me, that's a very dangerous path.
Are you looking at uranium?
Never. I think it's got a great future, but I have to say that I sort of OD'd on the energy story years ago. It was just too difficult to, I don't know, it never really engaged me. You know, I had a buddy 50 years ago who was talking about the great boom in coal that was coming, and it's really complicated, and I think that uranium has a good future to the extent that they've really developed, if not to say perfected, these small reactors that could be an excellent energy solution down the road. But even there, you have kind of, from an investment standpoint, you have countervailing pressure because a lot of the recycling techniques for nuclear fuel have improved a great deal. So, you know, there are two trends. I think the larger of them is a move toward nuclear power, which is probably the only thing that's going to solve our power demands. And you can probably look forward to a day when we have a glut of power that comes out of some of these megalomaniacs who, like Gates or Zuckerberg, who are talking about building their own nuclear power stations. They don't want to wait for the regional or local jurisdictions to build their own nuclear power plants. These multi-billionaires all want to jump into the game themselves. Some of them already have, like Musk in Tennessee. So to the extent that we've got an AI bubble, we could wind up really with the power supply bubble that will reduce the price of energy. Energy will be in a glut almost the same way that, let's say, fiber cable was in the dot-com expansion.
So much money has been poured into AI. Are people going to see a return? Because right now, the only thing I see happening from AI are massive layoffs.
Yeah, it's a great job killer, and it really hasn't begun to kill, you know. In other words, there's still lawyers out there doing stuff that we all know at this point AI could do a hell of a lot better. You know, I paid an attorney $2,000 an hour for a trademark issue I had with somebody who glommed my hidden pivot. My hidden pivot method. He just put up a website, and so I wound up paying a patent and trademark lawyer $2,000 an hour. But when you see the kind of issues that were sorted out, the other side had their own pricey lawyer too. Although he was a friend of theirs, so he did the work for free. So when you see the exchange of letters back and forth, you begin to understand that everything these guys accomplish was so logically and containably within the rule book of trademarks. You know, it was pretty cut and dry, really, and it's exactly the kind of thing that AI could do really well. The filing of trademark applications is so ridiculously and needly complex, but AI could make perfect sense of it. And of course, when I mean perfect, I mean in the same ballpark as a $2,000 an hour partner in a trademark law firm. So those layoffs haven't even started, really, but it's getting harder and harder to imagine some job other than the trades. You know, people that repair shoes and shoe horses and fix your, you know, plumbers and electricians, they're going to do just fine. But, you know, in the whole white-collar sector, it's really hard to think of a job that's going to stand up against the competition of AI.
Rick, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
Well, let me actually, as you mentioned that, to finish that thought, you know, you would question the huge investment in AI versus the revenue stream. And I went right into the layoffs part of it. But if you take it at a more basic level, like where will AI produce a multiple of the trillions of dollars that are being invested in it now as revenues? And no one has an answer to that, because there really isn't an answer. You know, the greater the use of AI, the more people who are going to be out of work. We're going to be going right up against Henry Ford's dictum about paying workers so that they can afford to buy your cars. So if everybody gets laid off, that will further diminish the returns from whatever it is AI has to, whatever they've got to sell us. But I don't know anybody, I mean, who's got the imagination to think of businesses and things that we will buy, you and I, in the way of services and goods, that can possibly measure up to the trillions of dollars that are being thrown at it now. So the paradigm has changed about every revolutionary technology creates more jobs than it destroys. That just ain't true this time, and it's so obvious that it's not true. And even if it were true, the horizon of the imagination is so distant that no one could even guess what the heck it's going to create that will somehow produce more wealth than produce more growth than was, and a multiple of what was invested in it initially. But we're in, as I mentioned earlier, we're in or committed to something like $10 trillion now. And that's a lot of bucks as far as what will we consume in goods and services to make that up. So somehow we're going to have to cross a valley, and I think the AI bubble is going to pop in a big way, but it encompasses so much now as far as the hubris and hype that you're talking about a very big bubble that's going to deflate.
Rick, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Hope I didn't depress you, Jim. But yeah, it's all... always a pleasure to connect with your audience, and I look forward to our next conversation.
My guest has been Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. If you have any questions for Rick or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@housestreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on X at House Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.